coming up on nearly a half century of the Clean Water Act, we look at what the future holds for protecting our nation's waterways and wetlands here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Passed in 1972, the Clean Water Act gives the EPA, gives the Army Corps of Engineers the responsibility to regulate water pollution. And the River Network, it called the Clean Water Act one of the most comprehensive environmental statutes in our country. U.S. Supreme Court, meanwhile, is considering a challenge to could essentially narrow the law's reach. Are you concerned about limitations to the Clean Water Act? Should states exercise more control over which waterways are protected? 800-642-1234. Patrick Parento is a law professor and senior counsel in the Environmental Advocacy Clinic at Vermont Law School. Pat, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks very much. Good to be with you.
Good morning. Do you view the Clean Water Act as the single most important law we have for achieving water quality standards for our drinking water and really supporting aquatic life? Why has this act been so monumental? Why has it stood the test of time?
Well, there are three basic pillars to the act. One is that there's a regulatory program for what we call point source discharges. These would be industries, factories, pipes, including some large farms in a dairy state like Wisconsin. That's an issue. It also requires states to come up with comprehensive water quality standards, which are the things that are needed to protect beneficial uses, fishing, swimming, fish and drinking water and so forth. Then the federal government has provided a great deal of money to the states to clean up, for example, sewage treatment. At many billions of dollars over the years, there's now a revolving fund available for the states to get loans to improve their sewage treatment facilities and other water quality maintenance programs. And finally, the federal government provides a series of laboratories that do all the kind of research that we need to identify emerging threats to water quality, most recent being what we call these forever chemicals, PFAS, PFOA. There's about 1,000 different compounds and chemicals used in everyday products that science has determined pose threats to human health. So, you know, the federal government through the Clean Water Act has a partnership with the states, and it requires very strong and effective state programs. But without the backup of the federal government, then states are not really able to protect their waters from pollution that's coming downstream from upstream states. So it's a partnership arrangement.
Congress hasn't, though, amended the Clean Water Act for decades. Do you think it needs an overhaul, in your view, in some way?
Oh, it very definitely does. It hasn't been renewed, amended, I should say, since 1987. That was the last comprehensive set of amendments. So we're way out of date with some of these more modern threats, including things like climate change, which is complicating just about everything involving with management of land and water and other resources. So, you know, but the problem, of course, as everybody knows, is that we have a divided Congress, and the environmental issue, including the Clean Water Act, has become a partisan issue. Unfortunately, It shouldn't be, but it has been. So it's been very difficult to get consensus in Congress on what needs to be done to bring the act into the sort of modern 21st era of managing water.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the importance and legacy of the Clean Water Act with Pat Parento. He's a professor of law, senior counsel in the Environmental Advocacy Clinic at Vermont Law School. You can join in. Are you concerned about what limitations to the Clean Water Act could mean for the future? Have you noticed an increase in pollution in streams or other bodies of water near where you live? Join in on the Clean Water Act, 800-642-1234. Pat, can you explain the scope of the waters of the U.S. terminology and how it applies to the Clean Water Act that is really coming under pressure through the waters of the U.S.?
Yes, Congress exercises the power that it has under our Constitution. When it comes to environmental laws like the Clean Water Act, Congress relies very heavily on the Commerce Clause, which means that you have to have a nexus between the object of your legislation, in this case, clean water, and Congress's power under the Commerce Clause. That's been a really complicated issue over the years. It turns on this definition of navigable waters. So navigable waters are, you know, waters that commerce moves through the waters. You can think about the Great Lakes, obviously, and how much commerce goes across the Great Lakes. So then you get to this question of how far does the concept of navigable waters reach? Because the limit of that terminology is the limit of Congress's authority. So even now, 50 years after the passage of what we call the Modern Clean Water Act, we do not have a definitive Supreme Court decision on the scope of that term navigable waters. The statute, the Clean Water Act, defines navigable waters to include waters of the United States, including the territorial seas off our coastlines. But Congress didn't define waters of the United States. The agencies, EPA, Corps of Engineers, they've come up with a variety of definitions over the years.
And the EPA, I want to just step in here because the EPA is trying to get what it calls a, quote, durable definition of waters of the U.S., which I, you know, kind of find interesting because last November, the EPA announced a proposed rule revising the definition. What do you see there?
Right. So there's been a series of court decisions that have complicated things as happens. And EPA's in the process of revising the definition of waters of the United States, which was adopted by the prior administration. And that decision, that prior rule of the prior administration, struck down by two courts in the western part of the United States, actually. So EPA is in the process through rulemaking, you know, notice and comment, giving people a chance to comment, of coming up with a new rule. And in the meantime, now, as you mentioned at the outset, the Supreme Court has taken a case to review the scope of EPA and the Corps' authority. So that's kind of where we are right now. We're in limbo on exactly what this new definition is going to be.
I wonder, since we've seen over the years several Supreme Court decisions and cases that have really addressed the definition of waters of the U.S., I wonder, do you see these challenges as problematic, or are they showing what needs to change and be defined about the Clean Water Act programs?
Well, we don't have any clarity at this point, I have to say. And there's a lot of concern about the Supreme Court stepping into this process now before EPA and the Corps have been able to come up with a new proposed definition. And, you know, that's a long process. I mean, the agencies are consulting with stakeholders in agriculture, in industry, in housing development. I mean, there's a lot of people that have interest in the way that the federal government regulates the waters of the U.S., right? So, you know, for the court to be stepping in at this point is problematic, at least in my view. It would be better if the court would wait for the agencies to adopt the final rule and then they can review that. But they're going to hear arguments in the fall, and it's going to be hotly contested. And prior Supreme Court decisions have not added any clarity, frankly, to the problem. And Congress hasn't done anything either because of this partisanship and the divide that we have. So we're really kind of stuck at this point, I think, in getting final clarity on exactly what is the reach of the Clean Water Act. How far up into the watersheds does it go? Does it go to headwater streams and their associated wetlands, for example? That's an issue that needs to be resolved.
Environmental law professor Pat Parento, our guide to the Clean Water Act, a test to what constitutes the waters of the U.S. Have you noticed an increase in pollution around you in streams, other bodies of water? Or do you feel there are greater protections over water now than in decades past? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Pat Parento here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the Clean Water Act protections and what would happen if the law would be narrowed as the U.S. Supreme Court considers this question again. How closely connected to a navigable river or lake does a body of water have to be for Clean Water Act regulations to apply, and how permanent How permanent must that water be? Are you watching the case Sackett versus EPA? How do you feel about the Clean Water Act at this point versus back in 87? Join in 800-642-1234. Vermont Law School professor Pat Parento is with us for about 10 more minutes. Let's bring on a caller now. We have Jake joining us from Appleton. Jake, hi, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for having me. You know, I just was thinking about maybe something that I haven't heard discussed yet regarding clean water and water quality, which is more like invasive species. It seems like every day or every summer when I go to a random boat launch or something, there's still milfoil, still invasive snails. I mean, is there any aspect of that may tackle that in a greater way? I know that it hasn't gotten any better, but I don't think it's gotten any worse. So I just want to know kind of if there's any provisions there for, you know, maybe more of a organic matter or things like that.
Jake, thank you for that question. Pat, what would you say there?
Well, the Clean Water Act is not a very good vehicle to address invasive species, which, as the caller points out, is really a massive problem across the country. There are other federal laws that deal with invasive species. One area that might be of interest to your listeners on the Great Lakes is, you know, you have a lot of international boats coming into the Great Lakes with you know, products and so forth, commerce, and they have ballast water.
Yes.
They used to be able to discharge the ballast water directly into the Great Lakes. That has been stopped. And the Clean Water Act does regulate ballast water discharges, and it requires particularly that these ships that are coming from all over the world, God knows what's in their tanks, right? So there's now a program for that specific source of invasive species. But more generally, we don't really that's one of the needs for updating these laws. We don't really have effective ways of preventing these invasive species from getting into these water bodies. Once they're there, what we know is it's very, very difficult, if not impossible, to get them out.
Let's bring on Jeff now in Delafield. Jeff, hi, go ahead.
Yes, good morning. Thank you. I seem to have noticed the increase in or degradation of water quality in the last, I don't know, 20 years, and I would attribute it to changes in agricultural practices. As agriculture has become more industrialized, we hear about destruction of grasslands across the plains, and all of that results in more nutrient runoff into our lakes and rivers, and I just think that is becoming an increasing problem.
Jeff, thank you for that. Pat, what is the impact of agricultural pressures on our water systems?
Yeah, non-point source pollution, runoff, as the caller was identifying, it is the major source of impairment of water in the country. And nutrients are probably the single most significant problem. That's what's causing the creation of dead zones all the way from the Gulf of Mexico. But Lake Erie, for example, has large areas now with low enough oxygen that no life can exist. And agriculture isn't the only source, but it's a major source of nutrient pollution. You get it from sewage treatment plants. You get it from urban runoff as well. But that's another area where the Clean Water Act is not functioning very well because it doesn't require permits for non-point source pollution, for runoff. For large factory farms, there is a permit program, but that's limited, you know, the really largest concentrated animal feeding operations, not the kind of runoff problems that are causing such real significant impairment. That's gonna be more difficult to regulate than pipes and industrial discharges, which we've done a very good job of regulating. That's a lot of land use. And of course, that's something where the states are resistant to having the federal government, quote, dictate or regulate land use practices. So that's a real tough problem to deal with. It requires best management practices. It requires a lot of investment of money and a combination of state and federal money to get that job done and restore these waters. So that's a big to-do for the Clean Water Act.
Talking with Pat Parento, professor of law and senior counsel at Vermont Law School, as we take a closer look at the Clean Water Act and what it does for our waterways and wetlands. With your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Pat, I want to circle back to PFAS. Federal regulators, they've been aware of the health hazards of forever chemicals for more than two decades, but we haven't seen the EPA set or develop standards for PFAS. Why do you think that is?
EPA is concerned about having a strong administrative record to support whatever number they choose. I mean, when you're talking about PFAS chemicals, we're regulating down in the parts per billion, and in some cases parts per trillion. So, you know, these are incredibly complicated toxicological standards that have to be set. That's why having an agency like EPA with the kind of expertise in these laboratories that come up with the studies that are needed to demonstrate, you know, how do these chemicals move through the environment when they reach, you know, human receptors, what organs are affected by these chemicals and how significantly are they carcinogenic? You know, that's, and you can't experiment on humans. So you have to do that through laboratory kinds of exposures. And then you get those standards challenged by industry that are manufacturing these chemicals, DuPont and 3M and others. And so EPA has to be able to defend whatever number they pick to regulate. So that's where EPA is right now, way behind the eight ball for sure on PFAS chemicals, but a long way to go, I think, unfortunately, before we have really enforceable standards.
Let's bring on David now in La Crosse. David, hi, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I live in southern Wisconsin. I live in La Crosse. And there's a lot of, you know, small creeks and rivers around here. And we've had the water bottling companies want to come in and start, you know, putting in their wells to produce well bottled water. And I'm worried it'll have an adverse reaction on our small creeks and river systems, because there's a lot of them around here. And if you just, like, they're all connected, you can't just take them and separate them out, being like, this is a river and this isn't a river.
David, thank you for that observation. Pat, what do you see there in bottling companies trying to find the freshest water they can?
Yeah, that's a water allocation, water rights issue. That's a state law question. The Federal Clean Water Act doesn't regulate water withdrawal or water use. But, you know, Wisconsin has a very strong public trust doctrine. And that would be the place to look for protecting streams from large withdrawals for bottling companies. Your neighbor in Michigan had a very significant case involving Nestle sucking enormous amounts of water out of small streams and lakes in the state, and it went all the way to the state Supreme Court. So that's where I would look for remedies for large water withdrawals that are impacting small streams.
I want to circle back to the litigation around the Clean Water Act. And if you could explain a little bit about this case, Sackett versus EPA, that's before the high court, and what you see there.
Yeah, that's about a family in Idaho that has a piece of land next to Priest Lake, which is a large lake, what we would call a traditionally navigable water body. And they do have wetlands on their property. They actually knew they had wetlands on their property. They hired a consultant who told them, you can't fill these wetlands without talking first with the Corps of Engineers. The Sacketts didn't do that because this is a test case. The Sacketts are being represented by a group called Pacific Legal Foundation. The PLF, as we call them, has been bringing these lawsuits for years, trying to roll back the federal jurisdiction under the Clean Water Act. So this is another attempt, and this time they got the Supreme Court's attention. I mean, the Sackett case was before the Supreme Court once before, but right now the case that's there is a really serious challenge to federal authority under the Clean Water Act. And it has to do with, you know, what's the relationship between a wetland? This wetland is within 300 feet of Priest Lake, so it's very close. And there's a stream that runs right next to the property as well. So, you know, what combination of connections between wetlands and streams and lakes is necessary to establish federal jurisdiction? That's going to be the question. In an earlier case, a case we call Rapanos, the Supreme Court couldn't agree on what the test should be. It split 4-1-4 among the nine justices on the court. So after that case, the lower courts began to develop what they call a significant nexus test. If there's a significant nexus between the wetland and the lake in this case, then that would provide federal jurisdiction. That's what the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals below in the Sackett case ruled. But the Supreme Court has said we are going to review whether or not we agree with the significant nexus test. And because we now have a brand new Supreme Court with three Trump appointees on it, who are very conservative, very suspicious of federal agency assertion of authority. All of us in the sort of environmental community, including academics, are very worried about whether this new, very conservative Supreme Court is going to establish such a stringent test for federal jurisdiction that we could literally be eliminating over half protection for over half of the wetlands in the United States. There are studies that show that. So it's a big deal right now.
Pat, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Pat Parento is a professor of law and senior counsel in the Environmental Advocacy Clinic at Vermont Law School. Just ahead, it's a look at the future of replacing lead pipes and the effects of poisoning with our state's lead policy advisor. Do you worry about lead poisoning from lead paint or lead laterals? 800-642-1234 to join in on lead. News update is next. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.